Hi, my name is Con Koutsikas and this is A Cuppa with a Conversationalist, an entertaining, educational and informative program with a broad array of guests with unique perspectives and experiences. And for more information about my coaching and workshops, visit my website at www.conkoutsikas.com. Welcome, listeners. My name is Con. I am the conversationalist, and welcome to another episode of A Cuppa with a Conversationalist. And yes, I have my latte in tow as always. This morning, my guest is a keynote speaker, a published author of 10 books, and a business coach that teaches entrepreneurs and small business owners how to double their income with public speaking. His entrepreneurial career started in 1999 when he and his best friend started a candy company that earned them, wait, over $75,000 while earning an academic scholarship to a top university. I've got to hear this. He's been featured in USA Today, Yahoo Finance, CNNBC.com, and over 200 media outlets. As a motivational speaker, he's partnered with over 240 colleges, organizations, and even the military to teach communication skills to emerging professionals in 45 states. A huge welcome to Odell Bazell. How are you, Odell?
I'm doing great. Excited to be here. Excited to be chatting with you.
Fantastic. It's an absolute pleasure to have you. Odell, as I mentioned in our pre-recording session, I listened to your interview with Robert Kennedy, What's Your Story? And I love the candy story. And whilst it's not directly related to public speaking, I'm sure there's some lessons in there that we'll chat about later. Mate, for the listeners, can you please tell us this candy story?
Yeah, man, the candy thing has been kind of a legend. So quickly, I played sports in high school. I played basketball, football, and I always thought that I was really good in basketball. And so when I left high school, I would think that the people would remember me for sports, but nobody remembered me for sports. Everybody remembered me for candy. And so it started out just my family. We didn't have a whole lot growing up. And so I made the varsity basketball as I was playing with the big boys as soon as I came into high school. And we had these team shoes and we had to pay to get the team shoes. And they were like $150 or something like that. And my mom, she said, "Nah, you know, there's no way I'm buying you $150 sneakers. You can forget it." And so I was like, wow. So I had to figure out how to get the money. She did give me half of it, but I had to figure out how to get the rest. And I started selling candy. And it was literally just to get money to pay for the sneakers. That's all. I was always like entrepreneurial. Yeah. But I didn't think selling candy would make a lot of money. Then I made money. And I was like, okay, this is pretty cool. And I was pretty popular in high school. So I sold candy. Then my best friend, he saw me selling, I think in geometry class or something. And he said, "Hey, like, can I sell with you?" And I was like, "No." And then he challenged me. He said, "I bet I could sell more than you." And I was like, "Oh, yeah, sure. Right. Yeah, sure. Okay." And so then I think our split was like 30-70. Like, he got 30% and I got 70%. And he sold like more than me. And I was like, dang. He was like, if I sell, I forgot how many bags it was. If I sell this many more bags, they were just little suckers. If I sell this many more, then we got to go 50-50. And so by the end of the week, we ended up going 50-50. And we made more money together than we would have apart. So there's a business lesson there about collaboration. But yeah, I remember my grandparents used to take us to Sam's Club. It was a big box store, you know, in the U.S. And we would get the candy and we would divide it up into our duffel bags at Justin's house. And it was just like a whole operation. We had no idea like anything about business. All we knew was we was making a lot of money. And we spent as much as we made, but it was fun. It was really fun.
I love that last line. You spent as much as you made.
Yep, we sure did.
What else do you do? That's an amazing story. Odell, it's a long way from being a candy entrepreneur to a professional speaker and trainer. How did that journey eventuate? How did you transition into that?
Yeah, so being when you're in business, and we were making a lot of money. I think we're making each about $250 profit when we were in high school. So for us at that time, that was, you know, a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And so when we eventually stopped doing it and went to college, the entrepreneurial bug was still there. We got to do something. And we actually went to the same college. Me and my friend, we went to the same mm-hmm. college. And so we were kind of going back and forth. Network marketing was something that we got involved in. And we were the youngest to be in those network marketing mm-hmm. rooms. And what we learned in network marketing, we learned all about personal development and we learned all about presenting. And that was the best mm. takeaway that we got, because we didn't really make any money. But
you're not an orphan there.
Yeah, not, right, yeah. Right. So once we got in there and our upline is telling us to listen to all the cassette tapes and the CDs, and you discover a Jim Rohn, you discover a Zig Ziglar, you discover them. And I remember being in my apartment in college, listening to Jim Rohn, an older white man from Idaho talking about his life. And I said, man, it would be cool to do that. Like, that was just the thought. It would be just be cool to be able to get paid to tell my story. And that was just in a vacuum, whatever, kind of threw it away. Mm. Then when I graduated from North Carolina State, I didn't have a job. I graduated right before what America calls the Great Recession, 2007, 2008. Mm. Didn't have a job. I didn't know what I was going to do. My public speaking professor came up to me and he says, like, what are you doing? And I said, I don't know. And he said, you should be a professional speaker. And I was like, great. Mm. What is that? Like, I didn't know, because when I was listening to a Jim Rohn, a Zig Ziglar, a Les Brown, when I was listening to those individuals and others, I just always either saw them on a DVD in front of a huge crowd, or I heard them just talking. And I just thought that they were successful and then people hired them to come in. I didn't think that was like a job, like you could actually do. And so my public speaking professor was telling me, he said, most speakers aren't famous. Most of them, they just have a message and they have an audience. And when he said that, I said, okay, I could figure out a message. It's just all about finding an audience. And so then I started speaking at colleges, because I just graduated from college. And I always took the principle of being a chapter ahead of the audience, not a lifetime ahead. And so if I could be a chapter ahead, well, these college students want to graduate. I did it. These college students want to do a side hustle and make money in school. I did it. So I just translated that. And it was difficult at the beginning, because I thought that we lived in a meritocracy, meaning the better I am at something, then I'll get paid, right? Like, if I'm a great actor, somebody will discover me and then I'll be box office A-list.
Yeah.
But we don't live in a meritocracy. And so I got really, really good on stage speaking, and then figured out, oh, there's a business behind this thing. Like, I just can't be really good at speaking and then somebody say, oh, wow, you're really good. Yeah. Let me hire you. There's a whole business behind it. And once I figured out the business, then things started moving really well.
The point you make about the meritocracy is interesting, because I'm still waiting for somebody to tap me on the shoulder and say, hey, Con, you're great. But those calls just aren't coming, Odell. They're just not coming, brother. Odell, what lessons did you learn from your candy soiree, translating them into your business? What key lessons did you learn or were translatable?
Yeah, I didn't. So when I talked about not knowing and understanding the business, I thought that the candy experience was me and Justin, that's my friend, we just got lucky. He was an athlete. He ran track. Our track team was like three-time state champions. They were phenomenal. I played basketball and football. I was one of the best players on the team. I just thought, oh, I'm popular. So people are just buying from me. But I learned, looking back at it and kind of deconstructing it, what we did was we solved a problem that the students had, and we didn't really know what we were doing. But what I mean by we solved a problem, we were mobile. So a lot of times in school, you know, students come and they sit in the classroom and they can't eat or they can't get a snack until they go to the cafeteria. We were mobile. The other thing is that we had a variety that the vending machines didn't have. And so the vending machines, they had one type of Skittles, one type of Starburst. We had the different kinds. And so when I thought about that, I thought, okay, so we solved the problem and we offered a variety, and then people liked us. People liked us. So that's why, again, I'll be celebrating my 20th year anniversary next year from high school. They still know me as the guy that sold candy. And so because of that, I translated it once I sat down and thought about it with speaking. Okay, well, what's missing? Okay, this is what is missing. Here's a solution that I can offer. Here's a variety that I can give them by packaging. So I started packaging my services, not just saying, hey, I'm a speaker, hire me for do 30 minutes, 40 minutes, whatever, but like packaging, let's do some things together for a long term. And then coming and being likable. And so a part of being likable is being findable, or being somebody being able to find you and your target buyer being able to find you and know you on a regular basis. So once I translated those things from candy, then it got easy. Mm. If I can be honest, it got easy because I'm still good at what I do, but people are finding me. They see the variety that I have to offer. And I have, I guess to a sense, I've ingratiated myself to my buyers.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you disappointed that they don't remember you for your athletic prowesses rather than for selling candy?
I used to be. I did used to be a soft spot because, you know, in your mind, and my dad always says this. He says, you're better in your mind than you were in reality. Mm. And so I always thought, my gosh, I scored 1,000 points in high school. I was, you know, I thought I was the man, if you will. I was like, they just remember you for
selling candy.
That's it. So, yeah, I'm not disappointed anymore because I make quite a bit of money. So that the narrative that they had in their mind is still true.
The money softens the spot for not being recognized as an athlete. I love that. We talk about, and you've mentioned it a couple of times this morning, your message. Now, as a speaker, we know our message is absolutely vital. What's the difference between an average message or a message that just isn't working for somebody and a message that just attracts and is just so engaging and positive? What are the key elements there?
Oh, this is good. I'm glad you asked me this question. It's like I was ready for this one. So there's a song. There's a famous singer. She's passed on, Aretha Franklin.
Yeah, well, everybody knows Aretha, man. Everybody knows Aretha.
And she had a song, and a part of the song goes like, I'm giving him something he can feel to let him know that this love is real. And so the message has to be something that people can feel. Here's the difference. A lot of people think they have to get people to feel something different, but they don't. If you watch a comedian, the feeling that, oh, he's funny, she's funny, they're funny. All comedians are going to make you laugh. They just make you laugh in a different way. So your messaging, if you're speaking, it has to get people to feel something. Make them feel a high. Wow, that's crazy. Make them feel a low. Oh my gosh, I can't believe that. And then make them feel hopeful. Wow, I think that I can do something better. If everybody's message has something like that, if you think of the big brands, you think of an Apple, you think of the big stores that are in your area or in your country or whatever, they get you to feel something. Like people that have iPhones and that own Apple, they think, and I'm an Apple person, I don't believe this is true, but they think, I'm a little smarter, maybe. I have a little more money. I'm a little more innovative. I'm a little, like, they think that, even though it's not true, really, but that's what they believe, because that's the Apple brand gets them to feel that. And so your messaging has to get people to feel something, usually hopeful. And I'll use a quote by Brian Tracy that I love. The religion of the people is hope. The religion of the people is hope. Everybody follows you if you can instill hope in them. So your messaging has to have something like that.
I read something quite interesting recently. People will remember how you made them feel, not what you said.
Yep.
And that's one thing that in my work is always really focused on. We're emotional beings, and what you've said is just so true. Is just so true. Idell, getting paid as a speaker became easy for you because of your entrepreneurial skills. It's not that easy for many others who want to go into that area. What are some of the key, I guess, firstly, mistakes, the glaring mistakes that you see people making in your coaching business? And what are some of the things that that you see done well?
Yeah, great question. I think with the coaching aspect and myself, I don't really like to coach, and I don't want this to sound any type of way. I don't like to coach people that are not good on stage. And when I mean good, you need evidence. So if somebody comes to me, they don't have a website, they don't have video, they don't have anything. Mm. I usually send them or refer them to somebody else because they're not ready to get paid yet. Mm-hmm. And so I usually work with people that are ready to get paid. And so one of the mistakes related to your question is people think they're ready with no evidence. And that doesn't mean that you're not good. I was speaking, I did 33 free paid presentations before I ever got paid. I focused on getting really, really good because I wanted to be worthy of that. And a lot of times we have to prove to ourselves that we are worthy of pay. It's not about the buyer. It's not about the client. It's about you believing in your heart of hearts that, yeah, I'm really good enough. And if you don't put in the time, then you'll never truly believe that. And you can truly never get paid what you believe you're worth. And so that's the first mistake. I think people don't practice enough. And one of my mentors and coaches said this. He said that professionals practice more than they perform. And so a lot of people think, I'm ready to get paid. You're probably not ready if you don't have that stage time. So that's the big mistake. What I see people do right is some people brand themselves extremely well. So if you have a picture of you speaking, a video of you speaking, I see people that even if they don't have a lot of experience, they look like they do. And that's the first step. And I'll go along and kind of interject this into my response. If you're looking to get paid to speak, I want you to listen closely to this. If you're looking to get paid to speak, don't focus so much on being an impressive stranger, but rather focus on being an impactful friend. And I'll say that again. Don't focus so much on being an impressive stranger, but rather focus on being an impactful friend. As far as it pertains to getting paid to speak, people do not hire strangers. They might hire you because they heard about you from somebody that they know, and then they looked you up, and then you validated all the things that they heard, but they're not going to hire you if they don't know you. People don't go look in the yellow pages and say, speaker, let me find, yeah, there's a speaker. Or they don't go on Instagram. They don't go on YouTube and say, speak. That's not how they find a speaker to pay. And so if you focus on being an impactful friend, here's what happens. I get to know you. I get to like you. You might not even know what I do. But man, I like this guy. I like this gal. I like this person. How can I help you? we all want to help our friends. We all want to help people that we know. And so then it's like, oh, well, I'm a speaker. I do these types of events. I speak here. I speak for this type of audience. Huh. Let me figure out how I can. And that's usually how it works. And so a lot of speakers, when they get started and they come to me, they're, oh, Dale, I'm ready. I got my website. I got all this. I got all that. I'm an impressive stranger. Great. Then I'm ready for you. Because what I do in my business and coaching is I introduce people to people that hire speakers. So I put people together like that.
Some absolute gold in that. Absolute gold. We all know that COVID has had a significant impact in the world as a whole, and it's impacted not only the speaking business, it's impacted a whole heap of other businesses as well. Live work disappeared, certainly, when COVID hit. Everything I had that was going on just vanished into thin air, and I'm probably sure that yours did as well at that time. What was your reaction from a business perspective, i.e. what did you do to, and I hate using this word because it's just one of these cliche terms, pivot. What did you do?
Well, for 2 weeks, I was depressed and afraid. I got off a plane. I was in Idaho, and I was at a conference, and they ended the conference early before, I think it was March 12th and then March 13th in the United States. They were like, nobody's going anywhere. Anyways. Nobody's doing anything. And I had, you know, $30,000-$40,000 worth of speaking engagements in the next month or so. And I'm like, wait a minute. And then I asked my agent, I said, how long do you think this is going to go on? And he was like, I don't know. And that kept being the answer. So for a couple of weeks, I was like, man, I don't know what I'm going to do. Maybe I ought to deliver some food or something. But after that, all I did is I connected to the people that had hired me before and asked them what they needed. And the beautiful part about it is they were, you know, thinking the same thing. It's like, well, what do you need? How can you help? And, you know, I was doing little things here or there for free, virtually. I'd already transitioned to doing virtually. I was already coaching. I already had my space. I already had my, you know, equipment and everything. So I was already there. And so then people just started saying, well, do you do virtual presentations? Like, of course I do. Like, who doesn't? Who doesn't do them? And so then I just got really good at doing them. And assembling my previous clients. And I can't thank them enough, because when I first started, I was super young, not just in age, but in experience. And a lot of those people, they're directly responsible for, you know, referring me and doing all those things. And if I'm good at anything, once I figured out the whole, this is a relationship business, that life is a relationship business, I was really good at keeping in contact with people. Mm-hmm. So the pivot for me was, I can do all of this stuff virtually. Yes. And then I happened to have a clientele that supported that. So that's what helped me. And I'll say this, virtual is not going anywhere. It's not going anywhere. A lot of people, a lot of businesses figured out, oh, we can kind of do the same thing virtually. So if you're a speaker, if you're an entrepreneur, period, having some component of virtual will help, you know, better connect, better ingratiate yourself to your former clients and your previous clients. And I'll say this, virtual is for myself as a presenter. I don't like it as much as being live and in person. Fiscally, it's a whole lot better, but I just don't like it. So you will, if you're listening and you're like, oh, virtual, you kind of have to go back and forth and figure out what works best for you, but have some sort of virtual component to help you.
From a coaching perspective, I understand virtually you can coach somebody on a business level. What I've personally struggled with is teaching somebody the skills to speak in public is a person-to-person or live interaction. Do you think that that is something that can be taught online? And secondly, a second part of that question is there a number limit, hypothetically speaking? You know, can it still be done in small numbers, or is it something that you can do in big numbers? What are your thoughts on that?
So I am from the old school, I guess. There's nothing beats face-to-face, person-to-person, public speaking. You have to do it. I think they're different skill sets. So like right now, I would say public speaking specifically, there's platform speaking, there's teaching where I'm actually walking you through something, then there's interviewing, and then there's emceeing and hosting. Mm. And so if I am platform speaking, if I am supposed to get the oohs, get the ahs, get the, oh my gosh, that's deep, get all of those things, I don't think that you can teach that virtually. I just don't believe that you can. But I do think you can teach somebody how to speak virtually. So if I'm giving a presentation virtually, and then there's a presentation in person, I think those are two different skill sets. They have some transferable things. You can pause, you can have good beginnings and have good transitions, but the body language, the nonverbal, you can't recreate that on through virtually. So I think that's one thing that's difficult to teach. And then as far as the amount of people go, it all depends on how much experiential learning and time that you give people. And I say it all the time, and I've heard it said different ways. You can't teach somebody how to swim at a seminar. You can't teach somebody how to be a very good public speaker or orator without them actually speaking. So I can give you all the tips and all the tools and all those different things across the world. I could do that. But I can't really assess if you're doing it until I see you do it. So like a video maybe could help. Maybe like if somebody's a video, but I don't think that is really possible at a high level. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The assessment part that you mentioned is key for me, because one of the things that I do in my courses here in Adelaide are strictly limited to 10. And the reason that they're only 10 is because they do a presentation every session and I evaluate it every session. And that's where their growth and development comes from. So that's I really do agree with you on that level. I guess from my perspective, being a bit of an old dog, I need to make sure that my thinking needs to evolve as this continues to go, because the world is getting smaller, and COVID made it even smaller with, you know, Zoom and even though they were there. So it's really important. Adele, I want to touch on your work with colleges and indeed the military and all the other organizations that you've worked with to help improve their speaking and communication skills. I saw a fascinating YouTube video, in fact, 2 days ago, by a gentleman by the name of Simon Lancaster. He's an English gentleman, and to suggest he has stage presence and oratory skills is an understatement. And what I found fascinating was that he said that in ancient Rome, oratory and rhetoric were compulsory learnings in schools, and mathematics was not. He went on to say that of the 20 major schools in England, there is only one school that teaches rhetoric and oratory, and that's a school by the name of Eton College, which is one of the top schools. Pardon me. He also went on to say that of the last 25 prime ministers, 19 went to Eton. Now, what I'm fascinated with is that, yes, there are a lot of things, we talk about life skills, that are not taught in school. you know, whether it's finance or whatever. And, you know, and I referenced the book that you wrote, you know, 8 things that your parents didn't teach you about money. But what I say to people is public speaking is not just about standing on a stage. And as you said, you know, Jim Rohn, 5,000 people in the audience, public speaking at its core is communication. And in the world of tech, I have a great level of fear for this generation's inability to communicate effectively. What are your thoughts on that, firstly? And then I'd like you to share more of your work that you do with these, with the colleges and indeed the military.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. I think that the ability to communicate, if we're looking at life communing with people, the ability to communicate is probably the greatest skill. Mm-hmm. If not the greatest, it's definitely up there. And public communication, and this is why I tell business owners all the time that they're public speakers. And they kind of look at me funny, like, what do you mean? I'm not a public, like, you communicate publicly. that's public speaking. And so that skill set is also, to your point, being thrown by the wayside. And so the work that I do with colleges and even high school students is learning how to communicate. And I work with organizations that want to teach their leaders the communication skills necessary to thrive in a diverse, ever-changing workplace. What we know is that life is moving like super fast, mm-hmm. but it always includes humans. People don't know how to communicate with each other anymore. They don't know how to have a disagreement without walking away saying, oh, they hate me. They don't know how to do that. So the fact that they don't know how to do that, it just increases more. It stresses people out. It makes their mental health, of the value of their mental health, go down. It makes them feel things that they shouldn't feel. And so when I work with college students, I tell them, you have to learn how to communicate with you first and foremost. And you have to learn that what is said about you on the outside world, you should say more about you. You should speak up. You shouldn't say, oh my gosh, I'm so dumb. You shouldn't say that because your mind only understands commands. And so what you say to it, it hears the most. And so if you're constantly telling yourself, gosh, I'm an idiot, you're going to act that out. And then you're going to let other people impact you. And it's all about communication. And I think that I have a father of 3 kids, 12, 9, and 5. The communication part of it is essential. And I'm grateful that I had a father, I had a mother, a grandmother, people that spoke to me, that taught me the importance of looking people in the eye. Do they do that anymore? Looking people in the eye, you know, having a handshake and you're having a conversation with somebody other than, let me see, hold on, is everybody good? Everybody else in the world good? Not the world right here. So that's something that I'm passionate about. I believe that if we learn how to communicate better, the world will be better. And as of this recording, I'm not political. I'm not, you know, trying to be political, I don't know what's going on between Russia and Ukraine. I guarantee that it's some sort of miscommunication going on, or some type of communication that was taken the wrong way or was taken the right way. Either way, there was something communicatively that went wrong between the powers that be, which caused all of that. So if we learned how to better communicate, how to help people communicate better with them, and then how to communicate better with the people that we serve with, our colleagues, our contemporaries, then the world will be a much better place.
One of the questions that I ask of in my groups, and I have so much fun with it, is first question, put your hand up, who's in sales? And invariably, when you do it in a professional organization, whether it's accountants or that's it, I'm not in sales. Right. And every now and then somebody will look around the room and go, I think I am. And go, guys, here's the first lesson. Everybody is in sales. We're selling every minute of every conversation we're having with selling and being able to understand that. And again, I don't want to get political either, but I go back to, and I can only speak for what's gone on in our country, because again, in the US, 50 states, it's a vast land. Our governments have done a terrible job of selling what's going on. A terrible job. And I've always said, if they were doing sales as a profession, they would starve to death. They'd freaking die, man. Die. Because they just don't have those communication skills. Odell, I'm passionate about watching kids. My kids are growing up now. You know, my son's 33, my daughter's 30, and my son's a school teacher, and he's an outstanding communicator. In fact, both of them are. They're outstanding communicators. I want to work in schools, but it's just like it's a closed door. It's like no. We don't want to know. We just got to focus on the curriculum here. What are some of the, I guess, strategies that you've engaged to, I guess, convince that what the work that you do is just so valuable and so important for these kids coming through?
For sure. So this is the part that I tell people, like when I work with them, you got to pay me a lot of money for this. But I'm giving it to you for free because we're spending time together. But this is the part. And you'll probably understand the first part conceptually, but when you get into the weeds, yeah, it gets a little more convoluted. Yeah. So educators and school systems and university systems and all they are corporations that sell education. That's all they are. Mm-hmm. And when you break it down to the barest minimum, that's what they are. So knowing that, who are they selling to? They're selling to the students. They're selling to the parents. They're selling the hope and dream of that. Mm-hmm. Education is going to be that prized possession. So I say it like that because it's really hard for a lot of entrepreneurs to approach that lens when you know, and if I can speak frankly, mm-hmm, when you know that the education that they're selling really isn't what they say it is. So that part is hard for a lot of people to understand. Once you get over that part, then you have to give them exactly what they need inside of a package that they want. So when I approach schools and I have a deal on the table with the local bank about how to spread financial literacy, they want kids to open up accounts and they, you know, all this stuff. And so how are we going to get into the schools? Like, it's really easy. They want the students to be excited. They don't want them to be bored. Hey, here's a fun thing that they can do. You can keep your students engaged. You can keep them. So what you want to do is you want to approach them, not with the overall goal of what you want, but the overall goal of what they want. And you have to kind of Trojan horse it, if you will. Yeah. You have to sneak it in there. And then that's why, in my tagline, I say, I work with organizations that want their leaders to develop the communication skills necessary to thrive in a diverse workplace. That sounds really good, especially the schools. It's like, oh my gosh, communication skills. And then when I get in there, I tell them what they really need to know, but I do it in that way. And so then when they bring me in and they understand it, because again, it's all about communication. Mm. If you can convey it the right way, then they'll be like, you're right. You know what, this high price education I have, it really isn't doing anything for me either. You're right. Like they'll whisper and they'll tell you that. And then the last part I'll say, as far as working with schools and education systems around the world that I've dealt with, most educators are overworked, underpaid, and underappreciated.
Yep.
This is something that you want to write down. If you're listening to, if you got to this point in the interview, you're into it. So you need to write this part down. If you're listening, what you need to do, if you want to work with those people, they're overworked. How can you help them do their job better? How can you make their job easier? Answer that question. They're underappreciated. Well, that's easy. Appreciate them more than their boss would. right? And so when you start doing that, again, it goes back to know, like, trust. They like you. If you take stuff off my plate, look, mm-hmm. I'll just say it like this. We're cozy. We've been talking for a while. If you say to me, Odell is a man raising a family, you don't get the appreciation you deserve, man. You should, gosh, here's something. Take yourself out. Just take yourself out. Oh, yes, you're right. Like, absolutely, I don't get the appreciation out of it. I don't. Wow. Yes. That's what you want them to do, because then they will pay you back by referring you or by paying you. So that's what I would say for anybody that wants to work with schools or anything. Just, they're all overworked. They're all underappreciated. They're all underpaid. So help them do a part of their life better, and then they'll owe you everything.
Really goes back to a couple of comments that you've made during our chat here, whereas it's about solving a problem at its core. It's not about, and it's not about us, it's about them. And we need to clearly identify the problem that they have through their lens, not our lens. And what you've shared today is just immensely, immensely valuable. Odell, as we wind up, what are, and you mentioned it just a moment ago as well, you know, the looking in the eyes, the handshakes, they've almost disappeared, you know, and I don't know what happened in the US, but we went through a stage here where people wanted to bump elbows, you know, this chicken wing thing. Man, I said, don't even think of that. I'd rather you did nothing. Like, just don't do that. So for me, I lowered my standard to a bit of a fist pump from time to time. But nowadays, I stick my hand out for people and they kind of go, Connor, is this okay? And eye contact, you know. So from a professional perspective and, you know, teaching all the communities that you teach and the whole demographics, what are the key elements? You know, we talk about the Pareto principle, 80-20 rule. If you were to focus on like 20% of the key elements to help somebody become not even an effective, a better and effective communicator, what would they be? What would they be?
Understanding who they are. I think that when you really understand who they are, it gets so much easier. And I'll give a very personal example. Mm-hmm. Me and my family, we're very devout. So we do what we call family devotion mm-hmm. at the end of the day. And the way my wife and I have been running it, we just been reading the Bible and reading stories, and my kids will be, whatever. And what I started doing was understanding, okay, they're kids. So what can I say? Like, how can I connect what they're going through as kids to this, you know, 1,000-year-old material? How can I connect it? And so I just started using things from the school. Oh, somebody's picking on you. Well, you remember when such and such was picking on you? Here's something in the Bible that talks about it. Now, what do we say about this? And so knowing your audience is critical. Because if I know my audience, then I can talk to, and I know what year they were born. I know what's ringing in their mind. I know what references to make. That was something I used to mess up when I used to just talk to high school students and college students. I was in my early 20s. So we were close to being connected in age. So I can make certain references about movies, about shows. Now I'm deep in my 30s. I can't make those same references. So if I'm in a professional setting where everybody's a little older than me, then I can make certain references, but I can't do it because I understand my audience if I'm with a younger audience. So if you're trying to get better and you're trying to be a more efficient communicator, it might sound counterintuitive, but figure out who either you want to speak in front of or who you're going to speak in front of. And that breaks down a whole lot of barriers, because there's nothing worse than coming on stage and saying something where the audience knows you have no idea who they are. You lose them no matter how little you say or how little you pace or whatever. You lose them immediately.
Yeah. sage words. Odell, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the program. Ladies and gentlemen, my guest today has been Odell Bazell, all the way from North Carolina. My name is Con. I am the conversationalist. And until next time, bye for now.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of A Cuppa with a Conversationalist. To join in next time, follow or subscribe. And for more information about my coaching and workshops, visit my website at www.conkoutsikas.com.